It went straight down the middle. Then it started to...
Just for our listeners, just to kind of recap as far as the chronology, here's Mark O'Meara winning the U.S. Amateur in the summer of 79. He gets to play in the Masters, qualifies him playing the Masters U.S. Open. So he plays the Masters with the defending champion and tees it up with Fuzzy Zeller. And then gets to tee it up with the defending champion of the U.S. Open, Hale Irwin, and the Open champion from Lithium the year before, Seve Ballesteros. But Seve had just won the Masters too, hadn't he?
He had.
So he was on a pretty good run as a 22 or 23 year old.
Yeah.
Needless to say, it was pretty intimidating.
Oh,
there's no question.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll talk some more about Seve later, but then you go to fall tour school 1980 and off you go, as you said, with just week to week grinding it out. Let me just recap a little bit for our listeners in terms of the professional career. 33 professional wins for Mark O'Meara. 16 PGA Tour victories, 5 wins on the European Tour, 3 senior PGA Tour wins as well.
Highest and a ranking, major.
What's
and
that?
And a major on the senior too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And ranked second was his highest ranking, I think, world ranking in 1998. Nearly 200 weeks in the top 10. Very well traveled, having won on 4 continents. And so relative to the PGA Tour, we'll talk a little bit about sort of year by year. I want to talk about some of your other wins before we talk about the majors. But Mark had a wonderful year in 98, won 2 majors that year, the Masters and the Open Championship at Birkdale. He was the player of the year that year on the PGA Tour. And just had a fantastic season. But as you mentioned, you titled off to the GMO, the Greater Milwaukee Open, which is I spent a little time in Milwaukee years ago, and in 1984 at Tuckaway,
yep,
dispatched young Tom Watson.
Yeah, I mean it was, and I was paired with him on Saturday and Sunday, so to be able to, you know, certainly Mike, to get your first win playing alongside a superstar like that was very rewarding. And to be fair, Tom is an intimidating guy. He's a heck of a player. We know that. But he was great. He was gracious after I won. He shook my hand. He says, Mark, congratulations. This is probably, you know, one of many more to come. And, you know, I never forgot that.
Yeah, that's great of him to do that.
So what else do you remember about that first win?
I remember that I was staying with my mom and dad. They were living in a little town just west of Milwaukee, in Delafield, outside of Maguanago. And I was staying there with my folks. And at that time, Alicia and I were looking for a home, our really first nice home, which wasn't really that nice, but it was nice. And so
it's all relative, right?
We'd found this house in Escondido, California, just north of San Diego in the inland corridor there. And it was really, we were excited. We thought we wanted to buy it. It was maybe, I can't remember how much it was, maybe $200,000 or whatever, $230,000. And I remember sitting with my father, and we'd been talking to the real estate people and this and that. This was the week of the GMO at Tuckaway in 84. And my dad looked over at me. He's like, you know, Mark, let me tell you, son. He goes, you should just buy it because you'll figure out a way to pay for it. And I'm like, God, you know, you always make it so sound so simple. I just wasn't that simple. So then we decided before the tournament started that we were going to pull the trigger and buy this house. And we did. And then
you
won the tournament and $54,000. So that helped the down payment with the chance to go ahead and, you know, do it.
Yeah, that's great. Great story.
Great history with that tournament too. We've talked to several of the winners, remembering, you know, there wasn't much purse appreciation in that tournament for a very specific reason. I think they tried paying about $40,000 back in 70 or so when Stockton won it as an attraction to keep players in the States from going to the British Open, which that year only paid $14,000.
Yeah.
The same week we paid $40,000 at the GMO. But then I think the tournament went into hock a little bit to kind of cover some of those bills. And I actually think it decreased the purse before getting it back up to the level that you won at.
You know, the purses back then, as Bruce knows, I mean, look, we played for $300,000. I mean, that was the overall purse. So, you know, we didn't know any different. I mean, that was a lot of money for us back then, you know, and many times I've told people, and Bruce would know this. I mean, that I think my rookie year, third of the tournaments that I played on the PGA Tour, I paid for range balls at the golf courses that we played our tournaments at. Yeah. There was no courtesy cars. There was no corporate hospitality.
Right.
There was nothing like it is today. And good on the way the game has changed and what the players are experiencing and the way that the purses have gone much, much higher, and the social media and all the other things that come with this that help push the game. You know, it's awesome to see.
Yeah, so Bruce, when you started, I suspect you probably brought your own range balls.
I believe that at one point in time we did bring our own range balls, and we had the caddy go out there and hit golf balls to the caddy. Now, I wouldn't have liked to have been a caddy back in those days, I don't think. But, well, look, as Mark says, times have changed with this wonderful game, but I think it's changed for the better. I think we see the game in great hands today, Mark, I think. A lot of these great young players, you know, they know their way around, how to get the press on their side. I think they're doing a hell of a job.
Yeah, it's not easy, Bruce. I mean, certainly it's different from the standpoint that all the things that come with the way the game has grown, you know, but the best thing I see is the amount of young people playing the game, men, women, children, young ladies playing the game, girls getting involved in a game that they can play for a lifetime. And, you know, I know everybody always has aspirations, as you and I both did, to be a professional and to try to compete and make a living and play the game at the highest level. But on the other hand, no matter whether you do or you don't, I mean, what other sport, you know, can you really play for the longevity of your life and the amount of friends that you meet and all the different walks of life, the business activity that could possibly happen on the golf course? There's just so many things that sets our game apart from all the other sports.
No doubt about it.
So let's move on to 1985, and I've got to ask you the obvious question. What is it about the Bing Crosby National Pro-Am and Mark O'Meara?
Well, you know, one time somebody told me, hey, that, you know, there's a game called Trivia Pursuit. I'm like, oh, yeah, I've heard of it. And they said, well, we just pulled up a question, and it was, who was the last player to win the Bing Crosby National Pro-Am? And so my sister, obviously she knew, and somebody called her and said, hey, you know that Mark is on the Trivia Pursuit question. And so that was kind of fun. And the fact that, you know, Bruce has been around there, has played Pebble so many times like I had. And I truly believe that when you play a golf course and you've had past success and winning the state amateur in 79 as a senior in college, there's no place prettier than the Monterey Peninsula. And Pebble Beach, you know, obviously it's my favorite course just because it would have been my favorite course if I hadn't really won many times there. But you're right. Like, I don't know what the reason is. Everybody always asks me that. I remember one year playing there, and I was playing with Ben Crenshaw in the Pro-Am. And the fact that you get to play alongside your amateur is tremendous. And we were on the fourth tee one time, and somebody in the spectator yelled out, O'Meara, you own this place. And I looked up at the guy and I backed away. Crenshaw was standing there. I'm like, no. I tell you what, if I did own this place, I certainly wouldn't be playing the golf as a professional golfer anymore.
How true. So, yeah, your love was so great that in 85, 89, 90, 92, and 97, you were champion at Pebble Beach. That's quite a record, Mark.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I mean, you know, you always dream as a pro golfer winning on these classic golf courses. And certainly Pebble Beach is known around the world as one of the best golf courses in the world. So to just win there one time would have been a dream come true, let alone, you know, the five times. I won the Crosby Pro-Am in 84 with my amateur partner, you know, winning the California State Amateur in 79. So a lot of people say, you know, you won there five times. I'm like, no, not really. I've kind of won like seven times.
Yeah,
there.
Right.
I'll ask you a question that I know the answer to. if you could trade in those seven wins for one of the three U.S. Open wins there that you competed at, which one would you take?
Well, I would take the U.S. Open win for sure. I mean, yeah. That would be a dream come true. Any major championship, it's hard to compare, winning a tournament a numerous amount of times and taking those over the fact that you could win one of the four majors. So, I mean, a major, and Bruce and I would we'd always say that always. That's something you would want.
Yeah. How much different was the setup at Pebble Beach for those three U.S. Opens you competed at there versus the setup typically for the Crosby?
Oh, it was huge. The rough is extremely thick and deep. The greens are much firmer. It's a different time of the year when we usually play the Crosby, and now the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. It was always, earlier in the year, the course was soft. It was usually the only thing you had to worry about, was the wet conditions and the rain. But you can never compare the way a major championship course like a U.S. Open is set up compared to a regular tour event. It's completely different.
And did you have a regular partner there, or did you play with a lot of different amateur partners over the years?
I think the first year, few years, I had the same amateur partner. In fact, 84, I played with a gentleman named Jack Diesel, who was the chairman of the board of Tenneco, which was a big oil and gas company out of Houston, and a guy named Gary McLaughlin, who was tight with Mr. Hogan because I turned pro in Hogan's office in the fall of 80, and I represented the Hogan company.
Right.
They wanted me to play with Mr. Diesel. So I was paired with Jack, and in 84, we made the cut and we were playing well. And I was playing well. We came down the stretch and we were on the last hole, the 18th hole, very famous, as we all know, along the ocean there. And if we make birdie as a team, we tie for first in the Pro-Am division of the Clambake. And I needed to make birdie to tie a guy named Jim Nelford, who was in the clubhouse,
right?
Canadian player, very good player. And so we both hit our drives, and I hit an okay one down the fairway, and so did Jack, and I helped him all along, and I laid up, and then he hit a 7-iron on the green. I hit it about 14 feet. So if I make birdie, I tie for first individually. If we make birdie, and I'm thinking, Jack obviously gets a stroke, and he hits the green, he's got about a 40-footer, and I'm over there lining up his putt, helping him, blah, blah, blah. And I walk away, and I thought to myself, if he two-putts this, it'll be a miracle.
Yeah.
And he made it for a birdie for a Nettie Heagle. Oh. And he jumped on me and hugged me and was like, we just won the Masters.
Yeah,
but he didn't realize, I hadn't won yet on the tour.
Yeah.
And I had this 14-footer. And earlier that year, I'd left one short and lost in a playoff at Phoenix Country Club. So I thought, if I ever have a chance to win on the PGA Tour again, I'm not leaving it short. And of course, I
hit
run it by about 2.5, 3 feet, and I three putted. So I finished third. But then the next year, I came back and I played with Jack again, and I won individually. So, and we made the cut. And then it was time, I asked my father. I played with my father in '86. We made the cut. We had a good time. It was a dream come true to be able to play with my dad in at a setting like that. And then after that was just a one and done deal. And then after I had won, as Bruce pointed out, in 89, I invited my father to come and play with me again in 90. And we played together and we made the cut again. And then I played alongside my father on Sunday and we were in the final group. And I went on to win the tournament individually in 90 with my dad right alongside me. So, there's no greater thing than, number one, playing golf with one of your children.
Yeah.
And or, watching your children have some kind of success. And certainly that was one of the ultimate highs for me and all of things that have happened to me in this great game of golf. Playing alongside my father and winning at Pebble Beach was as good as it gets.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm sure the tournament changed a bit over the years, from the Crosby days to then AT&T and more of a corporate sort of feel. Did you take full advantage of all the early fun in those early years with the some of the celebs and so forth?
Oh, yeah. I played with Jack Lemmon and Peter Jacobson a bunch. And then I played with Ken Griffey Jr. as my partner a few years. One year I played with Tiger, and Tiger was paired with, his father, Earl. And I played with the chairman of the board for many years, a guy named Bob Allen, who was the chairman of the board at AT&T back then. He was a very close friend. He became my partner. We played together probably 5 or 6 times in the tournament. So, I think those relationships that you make out there and the fact that it was such a unique event and everybody always wanted to play you know, back in the day with the clam bake with Bing Crosby. And, you know, so you look at all the guys played, all the entertainers played. And that's what makes it unique from the standpoint. You've got maybe people in the sports world that want to play, people in the political world, the entertainment world. I mean, it's in the business world. So the connections and the people you get to meet were fantastic.
Yeah. Bruce, I know you had fun with your regular partner there.
Yeah, I had. I played with Dean Martin for 10 years, which was a lot of fun.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, it was, you know, you sort of, like you said earlier, Mike, you know, you sort of dream about things like that, you know. I mean, how would you get to play with a guy like him for 10 years, you know? And it was like, he become like a brother, really, you know?
Yeah, you never forget those things, Bruce.
No, you don't. You can't forget them. Anyhow, that was a great time. And you mentioned about Pebble Beach being one of the great golf courses in the world. There's absolutely no doubt about that. It's you know, everybody always asks you, what's your favorite golf course in the world? I always include Pebble Beach in my top five. So, you know, it's ranked very high with a lot of players.
For sure.
So you can imagine, Mark, as we've been doing this over the last few months, I start pulling these stories out of Mr. Devlin, you know, and I will tell you that when it comes to Dean Martin and the Rat Pack and some of the stuff I'm sure he saw and participated in and witnessed, some of that stuff maybe will remain buried forever. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, we got to be a little careful.
Yeah, Miss Gloria may be listening. But you guys had some fun, Bruce. I mean, you talked going down and playing a riv or whatever to get ready beforehand with him and with his buddies, and that had to be a blast.
Yeah, that was great. I used to go out. Riviera each year and play with Dean and a guy by the name of Artie Anderson and a couple other guys and one of Dean's good friends, a guy by the name of Lou Rosenova. You may have met him. I don't know if you did or not.
Yeah, I knew Lou. Yeah,
you knew Lou. I'm sure you did. So, I mean, we'd play golf, you know, might be 8 of us, 12 of us, whatever. We'd play golf at Riviera, and then we'd go have dinner somewhere. And it was a great way to get ready for a golf tournament. I always enjoyed that a lot.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Well, what a fun tournament. Even as a fan like myself, watching it over the years and seeing Bing and Phil Harris, and you may not know, but our intro music, Mark, that will play in front of your episode will be Bing Crosby Straight Down the Middle.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. And, you know, look at Clint Eastwood, you know, the legend that he is and what he's meant to that Monterey Peninsula. You know, it was the invitation that you always looked for, you know, to be able to play in the old Clam Bake or now the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. And, you know, I a couple of years ago when Phil won for his 5th time, I remember calling him and congratulating him. And I also remember telling him, hey, listen, bro, next year, if you're playing really good and you're coming down the stretch, it's okay if you want to go ahead and peel one to the ocean. You don't need to win anymore. You've won 5 times now. Yeah. There's only one other guy that's done that. So you don't need to take away, you know, just stop. It's okay.
Records aren't necessarily made to be broken, are they?
Especially not at Pebble Beach.
Well, that first one in 1985 was by 1 over Curtis Strange, Lee Rinker, and Kakuo Arai from Japan, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
That's not a name
that was
I remember.
A long time ago. No, that was a long time ago, too. And I think when I won there in 85, it was interesting because on Friday, it was the deadline to commit for the next week. And I had played in Hawaii a few times, but I wasn't a big fan of going across. And I was playing okay, I guess, in 85. So I decided on Friday I'd go ahead and commit for the Hawaiian Open in Hawaii. And then I go on to win the Crosby in 85. And I think I won $90,000, which obviously is a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
And then I went across to the Hawaiian Open and won the next week.
Yeah.
And won at Hawaii and won another 90,000. So, yeah. You know, the story goes, after I'd won at Pebble, the week I was over in Hawaii, the Golf World came out and my dad got it. And, you know, it's just funny how my father, you know, he would always say, hey, I know you made this and you won that or whatever, but I saw that other box over there in the corner, Team O'Mara, you know, O'Mara won, you know, $6,000. So I'm like, yeah. And he goes, well, when are you going to send
where's
me my
$3,000?
Where's my stuff? I'm like, dad, you know, you can't accept prize money. You're an amateur. And he goes, no. He goes, I'm turning pro. So go ahead and send me the $3,000.
Well, by then the house was probably paid off or you had upgraded, one of the two.
No, it was, it wasn't paid off, but I tried. I'm not a big guy that I'm a guy that likes to have no debt. So after a few years, I played well enough to be able to pay down the debt on that house. So, and we lived there until 89. So we were there for about 4.5 years. And then that's when we moved out of California and went to Florida.
Yeah.
So back to back in 85, that was a victory by one over Craig Stadler. And our listeners might remember 2 years prior to that, that's the year that Isao Aoki slam dunk one for Eagle, right?
Yeah. Beat Jack Renner.
Beat Jack Renner by a shot.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that one.
So who was doing the television that day?
Well, that would have been you, Mr. Devlin.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, you know, to see him hacking it out of that left side at 18, the damn ball going right in the hole. I mean, I nearly fell out of the tower.
Especially when Jack had no idea he's in the scorer's category.
Yeah, like, no idea.
You know, I'm going to win, no problem.
Yeah.
And then I'm not even in a playoff anymore.
No. That was
kudos to Jack Renner because he came back and won the next
he
year.
He did. That's right. Yeah. Very true.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Good for him.
See, Mike, even us old guys can remember some of that stuff,
yeah.
But, you know, Mike, a little trivia question would be, and Bruce would know this, and we'll see, Mike, if you get this. It's quite an honor to have a green jacket. But you know what else I'm extremely proud of is I have a gold jacket. And you know what that is, Mike? Can you think of what a gold jacket is? I know Bruce knows. All right, time's up. The Australian Masters.
There you go.
Oh, my.
Gold jacket.
Oh, my.
Isn't that right, Bruce?
That's correct. And you have I believe you have another jacket, too. Don't you have a plaid jacket? Didn't you? No, I never won a Hilton Head.
No, you never I lost to Langer.
That's right. You lost to Langer.
He won there that year. But the gold jacket was fun because I held off a guy named David Graham.
Yeah.
Who was, as Bruce knows, I mean, luckily we went into the Hall of Fame in the same class together in 15. So David was, he was as good or the best competitor, right? Tough.
Bulldog.
The dog,
a bulldog.
Yep.
And Mark, you can appreciate this, but David Graham was our guest number one.
There you go.
And we did that one down in Dallas in person with him and Bruce. And, of course, a lot of fun because, you know, Bruce was like a big brother to him.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Yeah, it was fun. It's been a fun ride, Mark. Thank you again for being with us. It's a thrill to have you with us, man.
Well, it's easy when you're around classy people, and I put you at the top of the list at that, Mr. Devlin.
Thank you, sir. So after the Hawaiian Open,
You
had a little bit of an off spell there for a while. You didn't sort of what happened?
You know, that's what happens in this game. You know, I think what happened was is that, you know, you can't rest on your laurels, right? You have moments where you go through these peaks and valleys, and certainly 85 was a peak, and then I had a little bit of a valley there at 86. I remember playing in the Ryder Cup in 85. That was my first Ryder Cup, and I wasn't very good. I mean, I was intimidated. I didn't play that well. I always felt like team competition was a lot different, and I tended to put more pressure on myself. And then 87, I started to find my game a little bit more again. But yeah, I mean, there's been a number of times in my career where I've had some peaks and valleys, and that's not unheard of. But that's, you know, my take would be is, look, you usually improve the most, whether it's in your professional life your personal life, business life, whatever. In your down times, that's when you grow the most. You don't grow the most when everything's going your way, right? When you're winning or you're playing good, you know, life is kind of easy. But you really seem to grow a lot more, you know, when you're struggling. It's not fun to struggle, but you tend to get to the other side and appreciate it even more when you do break through.
True.
Were any of the times when you were fighting the sort of the lulls in your game, did any of that relate to any physical issues?
No, I've been blessed. Like, I never swung the golf ball that hard, so I never really had many, you know, injury setbacks that held me back from the game. You know, even at this stage where I'm 64, almost 65 years of age, knock on wood, I mean, I feel all right. I mean, I don't have a lot of issues when it comes to the physical side of playing the game. You know, certainly there's times where, as we get older, mentally, you know, your focus or this or that. And even in this break that I've had for the last, you know, 2 months or so, I've played one round of golf. You know, I haven't been, I don't worry about it as much. I don't let it beat me up as much. My desire to go out there and practice isn't that high right now because there's really nothing to practice for. So,
but you still, you know, like to play.
Yeah, I do. You know, like, I mean, I do. But the thing is I have so many other hobbies. There's so many other things that I love to do outside this great game that, you know, when those seasons come around, you know, that's where I want to be. And it's a great reminder of the fact that, you know, you if you get away from the game and you have other hobbies, I think when you come back, you're so much more refreshed.
Yeah, good point.
Well, you got back in the winner's circle in 1989, so I guess, boy, if you need a victory, just go play Pebble and
and then do it back-to-back.
Yeah, well, you know what happens once again? I mean, when coming down the stretch, it's not easy to win. You're nervous. There's players that are playing really well right around you. I think that my self-talk, I'll always remember this, my self-talk on the back nine at Pebble Beach was always, you know, hey, M.O., you've done this before. You can do it again. That's what I kept telling myself. And that doesn't mean everybody's going to lie down and let you win. You're going to go out there and have to get the deal done. You're going to have to hit the shots, and you're going to have to make the putts, and you're going to have to win. And I always putted well around Pebble because I grew up on Poana greens.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys struggle with those greens, didn't they?
For sure.
Yeah, so you beat Absolutely. A real good player in Tom Kite that year by one. Came back the next year, won it again. By two over Kenny Perry. And as you mentioned, you had your dad as your final round partner in that one, didn't you?
Yep. It was special. I mean, it was so good. I just can't even tell you. I remember playing the last hole. We were on the tee, and I needed to make a par to win. And my father, I was back in the olden days, as Bruce will remember, I mean, we played from, like, the same tees. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have, like, all these different tee configurations. And I always let my dad hit first. And, you know, he always hit it pretty straight or a little fade. One time he was a decent player. He was a 6 or 5 handicap. And by now he was, you know, in his late 70s or 76, 72, whatever my dad was. And he was about 14, 15 handicap. And he got up on the 18th tee and hit this low snap hook right in the ocean right in front of me. And I remember he was picking his tee up and he looked up and he's like, God, that wasn't a good time to hit one like that, was it? I don't know, Dad, just move over here to the side. And I hung on for dear life with my tee shot, and I got it down the fairway and we're walking off the tee, and he's like, what do you think I should do, son? I'm like, well, Pops, we're not going to win the team. I said, all I need to do is par this last hole. Yeah, just put your ball in your pocket. Enjoy the sunset. You know, it's on CBS, and blah, 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 blah. And he looked over and he goes, you know, that's the best damn advice you've given me all week long, son. And so he did. And, you know, I won and gave him a hug and a kiss on the 18th green. And, yeah, it was special.
Yeah, that is
great,
special.
Great memories. So sometime later that year, went down to Texas. And I'm sure Bruce knows this Texas-based grocer that sponsored that tournament, H-E-B, that was named after – founded by Florence Butt, but named for her son, Howard E. Butt, fairly famous grocer in Texas that sponsored that tournament for a while, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, it was played at Oak Hill, which Warren Chancellor was the head pro, I think, that year when I won there. And I even though I hadn't won that many times yet on the PGA Tour, it seemed like every one that I'd always, the tournaments that I did win, it was like I had the lead, or I had to, you know, I never really came from behind, you'd say, or maybe someone would mess up and, you know, you kind of slip in there and get a victory or this or that. And that year, I remember the last day I shot, I think 64 or something like that, because I was, there was quite a few players ahead of me.
63, and actually.
Was it 63? Yeah. And I think I beat Gary Hallberg. I think it was Gary Hallberg by a shot.
Yeah. True.
And I, cause I was on the range and remember thinking, okay, we're going to have a playoff and whatever. And luckily, you know, I didn't have a playoff and I went on to win the Texas Open that year.
And then next year went down to Walt Disney World, which that tournament back then was played at the Palm and Magnolia courses. You won by one over David Peoples.
Yep. I remember having to make up. I hit the green. I had to make par there on the last hole, which is a pretty long par four in the Magnolia course. Bruce would have played there for sure.
Yeah.
And I had about a, I hit the green, but I had about a 45, 50 footer. I left it 5 feet short. And I remember back then, I, you know, all those, a lot of those victories, even when I won the two majors, I was putting with a Ping Answer 2 putter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my favorite club in my bag. Obviously, it, and I remember that 5 footer, I was shaking like a leaf over it. And I made it. And I thought, this is why I putt with this putter. Because if it can make it, when you know that you're that nervous, this putter is not going anywhere.
The next year, another victory. That was your fourth victory in 1992 at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am. Had by then the Crosby name was off of it, but that was in a playoff with Jeff Sluman.
It was. I remember we tied. We went. I was playing. My amateur partner then was Bob Allen, who was the CEO of AT&T, and he had to get on the plane and leave because he was at a board meeting back east, so he couldn't watch the playoff. And we got to the 16th hole, the first playoff hole, and we both missed the green. We didn't play very well. I chipped it down there. I think I had about a 14-footer. He had about a 15-footer. He missed. And I hit this putt from above the hole that bounced around so many different ways. It was unbelievable. It looked like it was going to miss left. Then it looked like it was going to miss right. Then it was going to miss left. And then it bounced back to the right and it went in the hole. And I went over and I apologized to Jeff Sluman because I'm like, I mean, I've seen the video of it before too. It was all over the place. And somehow, some way, you know, it found the hole. So it was fate that the ball went in, but I was pretty lucky too.
Interesting place to start a playoff. Why 16?
You know, that's a good question. Back then, I'm not sure. That's a very good question, Mike. I don't know. I know that that's the hole we went back to because I remember in 84, when I three-putted the last hole, Hale Irwin and Jim Nelford went in the playoff in 84, and they went back to 16. And Jim Nelford, the fine player that he was and is, never won on the PGA Tour. And in that playoff, they went back to 16, and Hale hit a hybrid off the tee or a 4-wood or whatever, skied it, and he was in the cross bunker. I don't know if you remember this, Bruce. The cross bunker is only like 200 yards off the tee. Yeah, it's only like 200 yards off the tee. And Nelford hit a pretty good tee shot. He hit it on the green. Hale Irwin hit a 3-iron out of that bunker, a 4-iron. It was a long iron, and he hit it a foot from the hole and made birdie and beat Jim Nelford. And Nelly never won on the PGA Tour.
And I can't recall now, but that playoff in the PGA with Lanny Watkins and Gene Littler, where they were, at least Lanny was a little bit surprised that it was sudden death instead of 18 holes. I think that was the first sudden death playoff in the PGA. I don't remember what hole they played.
I think they went back to 18, I'm pretty sure.
I think
they
went to 18. Too. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
That was 77, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now we fast forward to 95, Honda Classic at Weston Hills Golf and Country Club by one over Nick Faldo.
I hit one of the greatest shots, Mike, of my life. When I look back, people say, hey, you know, what's the greatest shot you've ever hit? And I would tell you, because I'd had a little bit of a lull there, but that fall prior to that spring in 95 at the Honda Classic, I'd gone down to Argentina, and I'd won the Argentine Open down in Buenos Aires. So that gave me a little bit of confidence, not a ton. And we played at Weston.
Didn't you win it by a bunch?
I don't think so. I think I beat Stadler or somebody. I didn't win by a lot, I don't believe, down in Argentina.
Okay.
But anyway, so we come back in that spring. We're playing at Weston Hills in just outside of Fort Lauderdale down there in South Florida in the Honda Classic. And on the final day, you know, I had won in a couple of years, and I'm paired in the final group with Nick Faldo. And, you know, certainly Nick's one of the greatest players at the time and blah, blah, blah. We came to the last hole. I had a one-shot lead. And I remember on the last few holes that everybody's like pulling for Nick Faldo. I'm like, wait a minute. Whoa. I understand he's a great player, but he's a Brit. I'm a Yank. I'm an American. Come on now. And so the wind was blowing. Roger Maltby, NBC, was doing the telecast, and Roger was walking out in the fairway. And we it's a par five, and water all up the right, hit a good drive, laid up. We both were in about the same position. I was 100. I'll never forget. I think I had 147 yards, something like that, to the flag, and the pin was kind of over by the water, and the wind was blowing 40 at least in off the right. And I remember taking out a 5-iron and chipping a little held 5-iron shot. And I remember looking over, because Faldo was about a yard in front of me, and Roger looked over at my caddy to see what club I was hitting. And he showed, you know, he flashed a 5 to Roger so they could say it on the telecast. And, Mike, I hit this little chippy cut held up against the wind, boom, 12 feet behind the hole. And I will tell you, that was one of the greatest shots I've ever hit in my lifetime. Because then Faldo, who was a yard in front of me, tried to take out a 7-iron. And, of course, he tried to hit it hard. And Bruce knows, being an Aussie, it ballooned it up in the air, short and left. And I went on to win by a shot or two over Faldo. But I look back at that. That was a game changer for me, that shot.
That's a great memory. Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway, then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for 2, but it bounced off 9. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle. Quiet.